720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Coffin tonight. Thanks for being with us. I'll be with you till 11 o'clock, hanging out, talking about all kind of good stuff. We're going to keep the Justin Kaufman tradition alive, though, for Monday nights. We're definitely going to be playing the worst at 10 o'clock. I've got some special guests for you lined up for that. It's going to be lots of fun. Tonight, we're going to be talking about Facebook versus Trump. We're going to be talking about some new stuff on TV right now. We're going to be talking about the University of Chicago Trauma Center. We're going to be talking about that with some folks from Cranes. That's going to be really, really interesting at the top of the 8 o'clock hour. You want to stick around for that. And we're going to be talking about a new leadership organization who is really aiming at getting young professionals involved in politics and tons more, including the Lucas Museum, the Lakefront, all kind of good stuff for you tonight on the show. But you know what? We cannot possibly do a show today without talking a little bit about the IRS, just because we have this kind of wonky tax day upon us. And that's what a lot of people on social media are talking about today, because we know Friday, was tax day, but that got moved and now it's today, unless you're in Maine or Massachusetts, in which it's Patriots Day and you have until tomorrow. It's all weird. It's a whole thing. There's a good reason for it, though. It's Emancipation Day. We can all thank Abe Lincoln. The Emancipation Act was signed by Abe Lincoln on April the 16th, 1862, and it freed 3,000 slaves in the District of Columbia. So because of that, falling on a Saturday this year, it was observed on Friday, and because the IRS is based in D.C., there we go. We all got a little extra time on our taxes. Very complicated. I wouldn't want to be the person in charge of figuring all that stuff out for, who's celebrating what when and who's, when taxes are due. But nonetheless, tax day is upon us.
And so you had three extra days.
You had three extra days. And yet,
are you done?
I have no comment about that. Are you done?
I filed for an extension.
I'll be joining you in that and doing the same thing. So, there's lots of issues with the IRS, and it's very interesting to look at Twitter on tax day and the days leading up to it to see what people are talking about. Certainly a lot of people, just click on that hashtag IRS. So many people are talking about the IRS. A lot of people are kind of talking about what they would change. I wish X, Y, or Z was different, which, you know what? Let's talk about that. Give me a call, 312-981-7200. What would you change about the IRS to make them more likable, to make it more pleasant, to make us, want to actually do our taxes? I can't imagine anything would actually make us excited about paying our taxes and dealing with all of that. I don't know about you. I do not like red tape. It drives me kind of crazy because I want to put in a creative answer. I want to go with the essay answer, not multiple choice. I want to say, well, yes, I sort of qualify for that, and here's why, or here's why I don't. Or, I want creative answers, not just checking a box. So let us hear from you, 312-981-7200, about what you would change about the IRS to make them a little more pleasant. There is a really interesting story that is on Bloomberg. If you Google and search this, it's very funny. Three design firms got together and tackled this very idea of what they would do to make the IRS a little more appealing, a little more user-friendly. And the results are really quite funny. There's a company called Base Design. They redid it with a very, I think, kind of like internet meme, pop culture theme, lots of rainbows shooting out of the White House and, this kind of fun-ish weird font attached to it with the slogan of Fueling America, so people could kind of feel proud of, I fueled the military, or I fueled education, or something like that. So there was that. And then a company called Chermayeff, Geismar, and Haviv, they did a very subtle change. They really took issue with the existing logo of that eagle that's kind of got the scale around his little neck, and they didn't love that. So they turned the eagle's wings into a little heart to make it a little more pleasant. I don't know if that would really do it for me, but good thinking. And then there was the one I liked the most was a company called Siegel and Gale, and they put the whole thing on an app so that all year long you could be doing things to make your life a little bit better, so it wouldn't, so that the tax due date wouldn't be this big crunch, and it wouldn't be a bunch of drama and red tape and scrambling to get paperwork. It could be kind of all year long. You're collecting receipts by taking photos of them. You're collecting information. You're doing things like that. So that's kind of an interesting idea. I don't know how safe or private, that would be. It would be certainly a kind of a security nightmare to be doing your taxes by an app. But I like the idea of it being that convenient and that easy for sure. Again, what would you do to make the IRS experience a little better? What would you do to make, I don't know, paying taxes kind of fun? Or maybe not fun, but at least tolerable. 312-981-7200. Demetria, hi, you're on WGN.
Oh, hello. My idea is that the first $20,000 should be the general deduction, the standard deduction for the taxpayer. Oh, a spouse, whether they work or not, the second person's deduction would be $10,000. And then, maybe $4,000 for each other dependent, whether it's a parent or a child, because so many people make less than $50,000 a year and they're already paying very little in income tax. I mean, they get their check back after the during the refund season, but that would make it much easier for low-income earners to be able to pay their bills and not worry about whether they're going to have a roof over their head.
Demetria, have you thought about running for office?
Yeah, but I know too many people who did naughty things when we were young.
There's evidence would come back and haunt you.
Well, you know, if they can point at candidates who are real politicians out there running and say, you had this problem back then, and you've got a friend who did this bad thing, and you have a friend who lied about something, you know, that smear campaign thing, you got to have a real thick skin to withstand it.
That's true.
That's why so many of the politicians seem cold or indifferent or even hostile, because they're on the defense all the time.
Well, that's true. I was going to say, it hasn't stopped, having dirt in their past has not stopped plenty of people from running for office. Thanks so much for the call, Demetria. Have a great day.
You too.
Hi there, Dan, you're on WGN. What would you do to fix the IRS?
Did you say Dan?
Yeah. Hi, Dan.
Yeah. Hi. Sorry. I've always thought it'd be nice if we had some type of restricted fund donation, like you can do to a charity, where, maybe 75% of your tax dollars the IRS takes to the general fund. They take all of it now. And 25 or some percentage can get earmarked based on where you'd like it to go. So the IRS could provide you the option to donate it to military, donate it to road civil service, maybe the National Park Service, but you could restrict or at least feel like you are contributing the portion you'd like to see go specifically for a purpose, right?
I like that.
I would be happier paying my taxes if I knew I could give, 20% of what I pay goes to the National Park Service, right?
Yeah.
And maybe 15% of what I pay goes to the U.S. military. I mean, a lot of it you have to leave, obviously, in the general fund so that the government can decide what to do with it. But if I could earmark some of that money for a particular purpose, and they may give you, 10 options, right, of things that they're going to spend money on, maybe you'd feel like, okay, I know that 20% of what I'm paying is now going to preserve national parks, right? But for me, that would make it a more interesting process to pay my taxes and probably feel better that at least a portion of that is going to directly to somewhere I'd like it to go, not unlike your restricted funds when you donate to a charity.
Right. I love that idea. That's a good one. I hope that you run for office and put that into use for us. Thanks so much for the call,
Dan. Yeah, that's probably not going to happen. Yeah, you're welcome.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little bit of a break, but we're going to come back in just a second. I want to hear from you, 312-981-7200. What would you do to make paying taxes a more pleasant experience? How would you change the IRS? Let's hear from you. Again, that's 312-981-7200. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN, Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight with you till 11 o'clock. My friends, we are talking about the IRS. What else? What else would we be talking about today? In particular, I want to know, what would you change about the IRS to make paying taxes more pleasant? So there's a municipality in India that has taken an interesting approach, and that is they have decided to hire a group of drummers, like a big drum band, will come to your house if you do not pay your taxes, and they will play their drums very, very loud. until you go and pay your taxes. So shame is one way. So that's one thing. We could implement that. But what would you do to make it better? Not just fix the problems, but, you know, make better. Hi, Susan. You're on WGN. What would you change about the IRS? Hi, Susan.
Oh, I'm sorry, Amy. I didn't hear my name.
That's all right.
Yes, to me, tax time is stressful.
Yeah.
And I think that there's no reason to – everybody's under stress.
Sure.
The people who work for the IRS, the taxpayers, the tax accountants, the CPAs, the EAs, everybody's under stress. Why are we doing this in one fell swoop, March 15th for corporations and April 15th for individuals? Why not spread it out over the year? And just make it so that then we have fewer seasonal employees. People aren't just everybody losing their minds, but we all have a tax ID number. For you and me, it's a Social Security number. If yours begins with a 1, then maybe yours are due February 15th. And if you're a 2, yours are due, March 15th. And spread it out over the year so that it's a little less stressful. And hopefully then we have, more full-time employees at the IRS who really know the code and what they're doing, and fewer seasonal employees that are really not a heck of a lot of help.
Right, that have to warm back up at the beginning of tax season, right after forgetting things over the summer. That's a good idea. Like it. It's a good one. Thanks so much for the call, Susan. Have a great day.
Mm-hmm.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about the University of Chicago and the Trauma Center. And we're going to be talking about Trump v. Facebook. Really interesting stuff on both counts. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight with you till 11 p.m. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being with us. I don't know if you know this, but some interesting stuff has been happening at Facebook lately. And we all know it's a place where we can go and know exactly down to the minute what our friends think about politics and some of our relatives that we may not quite agree with. But interestingly, this week, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg appeared to publicly denounce a lot of the political positions of Donald Trump's presidential campaign during a keynote speech of the company's annual F8 developer conference. But that was not all. He gave some examples. He said things like, "I hear fearful voices calling for building walls and distancing people they label as other." He said things like that. He didn't name Trump, but he pointed to a lot of things that he has said in his campaigning. But that's not all. This conversation around Facebook and Trump was happening inside Facebook's walls, too. So joining us now is tech editor at Gizmodo, Michael Nunez. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So talk to us a bit about this, because it's very, very interesting. It's created a little bit of a stir because this conversation was happening not only with Zuckerberg at this conference, but with his employees, too. And they kind of said, hey, should we stop the Donald Trump presidency, which is a really kind of interesting position for Facebook employees to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. So, so we obtained evidence that at least one Facebook employee had asked the question, what responsibility does Facebook have to help prevent President Trump in 2017? And so, of course, that was an interesting question to us, and we started looking into that. And I think what was most surprising while reporting this was learning that, in fact, Facebook has a lot of the same legal rights as a traditional media company, so something like the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune. So, in fact, they can block or promote any material that they want in the same way that an editor could select his or her favorite stories of the day or the ones that they think are most important. The key difference between the Tribune and Facebook and also the Times, the New York Times and Facebook, is that Facebook reaches over more than 1 billion users in the world. So you're talking about millions and millions of Americans, of voting Americans. And I'll add to that that we also discovered that Facebook had very publicly, recorded results from secret tests that they had run conducted on their users. So during the 2008 election and also during the 2010 and 2012 election, Facebook had conducted tests or basically secret experiments on people that were using the service, and the results were pretty astonishing. You know, the essentially Facebook has a dramatic impact in people's lives. It helps shape their worldview. It can change their mood, and it can also have real world implications too. You know, they have caused more people to go out and vote, at least according to one study that Facebook researchers published. So, you know, the effects are profound and the influence is profound. And so, you know, we're really just trying to raise some of those questions.
Right. I mean, we compare that to the right of a journalist to kill a story or to run a story. But then I think there, you know, another difference, though, is the conversation around newsworthiness, that even, you know, in a newsroom, even something you, you know, may not want to, you know, or personally be interested in or personally want to be, you know, a widely shared story there, on some level, you know what is newsworthy, and therefore ethically you have to report it. And so I think the ethical conversation here is an interesting one. Does Facebook, you know, can they ethically block all this Trump content and, you know, ostensibly decrease interest in Trump as a candidate, I think is really the question now.
Well, you know, yeah, again, that's gonna depend on who's answering the question. You know, I think from an editor's perspective, you would hope that a publication or any news platform would be used to provide very fair and very accurate information, right? You know, they should be covering the presidential election, and they should give a voice to the candidates. I think what's scary is that, you know, if the New York Times decides not to publish a Donald Trump story on their front page, that the equivalent for Facebook is to maybe downgrade or bury Donald Trump stories in the newsfeed. I you know, the impact of Facebook's decision is so much greater than any traditional news company that, you know, it's really hard to say what it should morally do. And I think for me, the most interesting question is sort of learning more about how the algorithm works and how it decides what's important. You know, ultimately, you're putting your trust into this machine and you're expecting it to spit out a fair view of the world. And I think, you know, some of the questions that have been raised in my mind is like, who's deciding that view and what responsibility do they have to the public? And since it's a business, you know, can we regulate that? Should it be regulated? Like, will there be a conversation about the type of influence that Facebook can have on the presidential election?
Right. I mean, it is interesting, and I think about this very topic a lot, because we for the most part, I think most of us, even subconsciously, tend to surround ourselves with social media network members that are relatively like-minded. You know, I think it's impossible to say that you have a completely fair and balanced representation of the news on any social media outlet, just because you tend to, you know, be friends with people who think like you do, and therefore you're going to be friends with them on Facebook and follow them on Twitter and things like that. So I think there's already our own biases filtering in there. But I think often, especially during election time, I think often about media literacy, because here we are in a time where we have greater access to information than ever before in the history of the world, and yet I think so many elections are decided on headlines and on, you know, email forwards and things like that. Then rather than people reading an article, they'll say, hey, did you read this New York Times story about so-and-so? They'll go, yeah, I saw that. They won't say I read that. They'll say I saw it, meaning I looked at the headline, or maybe I read, you know, the lead or something like that. And that kind of thing keeps me up at night. I don't know about you, but it keeps me up at night, because I think it's, you know, here we are with so much information at the ready, but we're so bombarded. Even I found myself, if I share something really compelling on Facebook or that I think is really compelling, I'll even say, hey, you guys, read this. Don't internet read it. Really read it, meaning read the whole thing. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, when it comes to literacy and just knowing where your information is coming from, I think there is a special skill required to do that. And in fact, a lot, you know, the way that Facebook runs its news team is reflective of that. They hire journalists to basically help with their news operation, and it's because it takes a certain type of person to identify you know, what's important and what's not, and sort of and prior, you know, help prioritize the news and help find original sources on things. And you know, there's a lot of importance to that when it comes to being able to speak intelligently about sort of what's happening in the world. And you know, I know that Facebook definitely has invested a lot of their resources into making sure that they show a very full scope of what's happening on the network. You know, I think with this, what is strange is that it struck me as really odd that Mark Zuckerberg seemed to publicly denounce Donald Trump, or at least was publicly opposed to some of the, you know, the key political issues of Donald Trump's campaign. You know, when he made that speech at his company's annual developer conference, it was just so off topic. It was the first thing that he said, and it was so far away from what everyone was expecting, and it had nothing to do with the business, and it was really not in any way tied to his products. And I think that was really striking, because it showed a willingness to sort of blend that world, to mix, you know, his political preferences and his idealism with the business that he was conducting. And you know, when you combine that with sort of in addition to the fact that we were able to obtain conversations happening amongst the Facebook employees, I think it's startling. And you know, there are a lot of questions that I have about who has access to the massive trove of information that Facebook is gathering and ultimately, you know, deals in every day. They're sort of just a trafficker of information. And there are only a few small groups in Facebook that sort of that help shape that conversation online, and so that's what I'm most interested in. It's really just how, like, what Facebook's role in the presidential election is, and how that will change over time, and the real world effects that they can have on U.S. voters. I mean, it's, you know, some of the things that I found during the reporting process were astonishing, and I just hope that other people start to ask themselves those questions. So you know, beyond literacy and reading more, I think it's just knowing where you get your information and who's controlling those decisions and sort of where the information's coming from.
Definitely. Do you have any indication that perhaps there's any backlash from Trump supporters towards Facebook, or is there, you know, any talk of boycotting Facebook or doing even more on Facebook to try to counter any potential, you know, algorithmic change or anything like that?
No, you know, at this point, I don't think, you know, I don't think the reaction has been big enough. You know, of course, there's been, you know, some public reaction to at least me online, but like, I don't think that there is an outcry from Donald Trump supporters, and he himself helped sort of calm the tension between he and Zuckerberg this weekend when he was on a Fox program. He said something about not, you know, not really minding, like he wasn't too worried about Facebook. So I think in Trump's mind, it's totally fine. I haven't really seen a backlash from Trump supporters, but you know, I also think that the conversation is really just starting. You know, we, you know, last week Mark Zuckerberg said something really unique, and I think that that we wanted to call attention to that, and I hope that we successfully did, and I hope that people start to ask questions about how he conducts his business and the type of influence that it has over all of us, and I think that, you know, in my mind, this is really just the tip of the iceberg. I think that, you know, the more that I pry into sort of what's going on in Facebook, I think the more that I learn that its influence is huge. And you know, I just don't think a lot of people are thinking about how much information they have about everyone and why that's a little disconcerting, or should be.
Yeah, I mean, you point to, in this story on Gizmodo, you point to the 2012 experiment when Facebook deliberately tried to toy with our emotions and make us have certain emotional reactions and track that for, I don't remember what the number was, but it was, I think, millions of people or something like that, that they were intentionally, you know, tweaking what we saw in our news feeds to try to elicit certain reactions. And that's, you're right, that's, you know, when it gets like that, that gets very disconcerting.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So the emotion study that you're talking about was 700,000 people, and they were able to prove that they could essentially mess with people's emotions by playing with things like feeding them hard news or soft news or things that are funny or sad, and they've very freely experimented with the news feed because as a business they have every right to, and this is something that's very new. You know, I think that Facebook has it's an older company at this point. It's no longer a startup just being run out of someone's house. It's a multi-billion-dollar company that's publicly traded and has recently bought very, very big social networks and even video game platforms, you know, virtual reality platforms. And so it's not the same Facebook that it used to be, and I think that sometimes people forget that this is, you know, a massive corporation and it's earned its fortune by collecting information about its people and also just becoming sort of a ubiquitous part of everyone's life. It's, you know, it's really hard to avoid Facebook, and that's because it's helpful. It's actually a very useful tool, but you know, I think because so many people rely on it for so many things, it should also be questioned a little bit. And I think that, you know, there deserves to be some conversation about the way that it conducts its business. And if we're all going to freely, offer our information and our data and our photos and videos and everything else to Facebook, I think that, we deserve to ask questions about what they're doing with that information and how they're operating the business behind the scenes.
Most definitely. Everybody, head to Gizmodo. Check this story out. It's really, really interesting. Michael Nunez, tech editor over at Gizmodo, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, and we come back more of this fun here on 720 WGN. WGN, Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight. Thanks for being with us. We were just chatting with Michael Nunez, the tech editor at Gizmodo, about this really interesting thing where Mark Zuckerberg was kind of talking, was hinting, he didn't say Trump, but he was hinting at some Trump campaign tactics at his speech in a developer conference. And this screenshot got leaked from a Facebook employee asking if we, meaning Facebook employees, should try to suppress Trump content to make sure he doesn't become president. And so it's raised all of these ethical questions. Legally, they certainly have the right to do that. They can share whatever they feel is they want to share. Some legal experts weighed in. And again, head over to Gizmodo and look at this story. It's really, really interesting. Some legal experts weighed in and said really it would only get dicey if they were to be conspiring with a candidate to boost their content or to.
Right. Well, legally it seems fine, but ethically is more of the question. But I've been thinking about the algorithm a lot on a more micro level, like mm-hmm. when I post something and it doesn't get
like
as many.
Like how you're trying to block me on Facebook all the time.
Well,
also then, that's neither here nor there.
During the news.
We'll duke it up then.
But when you post something and it doesn't get as many likes as you would want,
yeah,
it's useful to be able to blame the algorithm and just say, well, they didn't boost me as much as I deserved.
I think it's really interesting when you post from a third party. Like if you schedule the post, I like Buffer, but that's a great tool to schedule your social media posts. So sometimes if it's a story that's like it's not really particularly urgent that I share it right that second, or it's just an interesting article that I read that I would like to share, a lot of times I'll just schedule it when I know that I'll be busy doing something or something like that, just so I have like consistent updates to my social media. But I've noticed if you export, say, an Instagram photo or use something like Buffer, or I like selected tweets where I don't like to simultaneously update my Twitter and Facebook with the exact same thing, but once in a while I want to export it. those things that come through on that third party, they barely get any likes. I think people don't see them.
Okay. So they're shutting those down for some reason. They don't like you messing with other social media.
Right.
That
especially
makes sense to me.
Especially selected tweets.
Right.
That one, I rarely get more than, I mean, I probably average, you know, between 1 and 200 likes on a post. Every, you know, anything I post publicly.
And there's no way it's that your tweets aren't, you know, just performing well. Like, what if everybody was seeing them? This is
they
not
just
a comment on your Twitter.
Right. There's like, no, we saw it, Guth. We just think it's super lame.
I think it's important to remember that that's a possibility.
It's
I don't think that that's actually the case, but you never know.
I mean, but you never know. But then the other day, I put Ned Flanders is my Uber driver because I was in an Uber and the guy seemed exactly like Ned Flanders and even kind of looked like him and sounded like him and all that. So I put that on Facebook and like it was just such a small little comment. I wasn't commenting on the world or fixing the hunger crisis or anything like that. And I got, you know, a lot of people interacted with that and left comments and things like that. But I almost did it as Select Tweet, which is a service that allows you to just
right.
Send a tweet and then put a special like pound FB at the end, hashtag FB at the end of your tweet, and it will automatically export it to Facebook. I don't even use that anymore. I'd rather go separately. Your phone's ringing there, Griffin. I'd rather separately go, you know, update both social media platforms with the same thing. Although I don't generally agree with that because I think it's important to be unique on all of them. Rant over. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll get you to news. And then we are going to be talking about the University of Chicago's Trauma Center. Lots of interesting information there. And we're going to be joined by some very, very important voices from Cranes. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight. Thanks so much for being with us. Here with you until 11 o'clock. Coming up at 10, we're going to be playing The Worst, as he always does on Monday night. So get your grievances ready. It's like Festivus right here in the middle of April. All right, my friends, you know what? There's so much to keep track of around the University of Chicago, the Adult Trauma Center. That's been in the news for years here in Chicago, and it's been a really, really big pain point. It's been a big area of discussion in this city, and it's very, very, there's so much to it. Tonight I'm joined by Kristen Schorsch and Claire Bushy from Cranes. You can read this. They did the series on this. It's a big two-part series. Read it at chicagobusiness.com. It is really, really interesting, how they have broken it down and tackled this. Welcome to the program, Kristen and Claire.
Thanks, Amy.
Claire, I realize you're a bit jet-lagged, but thanks for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. And Kristen, of course, welcome to you, too. So kind of take us through this a little bit, because I think we, like all of us in Chicago, but I think so many of us have heard about this story so many times, it's hard to keep up with all the details. And it's really, really difficult to even kind of get your head around it because it's so complex. And the narrative has changed a little bit just recently. But if you could please kind of take us through, well, first of all, what really led you to this story and why now?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, this is Kristen. So I cover healthcare at Cranes, and I've been writing a lot about over the last year or two, just the evolution of University of Chicago Medicine's reversal on trauma care. You know, first, there were all these, you know, activist protests that had been going on years before calling for this. And then in the fall of last year, in September, they announced a surprise deal with Sinai Health System to open a trauma center at Holy Cross Hospital in Marquette Park. And then in December, all of a sudden, abruptly decided to just do it on their own. And so Claire and I teamed up and just decided, you know what, this is really a big question worth asking is, what really fueled this change of heart? You know, the activists had been calling for this trauma center for years, and U of C was pretty adamant against doing it. You know, with a big caveat, it's really expensive to open an adult trauma center. They, like a lot of other hospitals in Chicago, had one in the 1980s and were inundated with patients. And the typical trauma patient is on Medicaid or is uninsured, and it can cost about $30 million a year, not only to open a trauma center, but to operate it every year. So it's really a mission-driven, you know, task. It's really hard for hospitals to take this on. Even for the richest hospitals, they really flinch at considering this because then they might have to sacrifice other programs. So essentially, Claire and I really wanted to tackle that question of, well, what really fueled this change of heart? All of a sudden, University of Chicago Medicine decided to open this highly specialized trauma center. There's been a gap on the south side for years, you know, ever since Michael Reese closed their adult trauma center. So we just wanted to really kind of visit all sides of this. And so a big part of that was exploring not only the evidence behind it, like, is there really a need for this, but also, you know, Claire tackled the, you know, talked to a lot of the activists and tackled that point of view of kind of describing the evolution of their protests and their campaign set against this backdrop of a lot of shifting politics, racial undertones happening in the city of Chicago at the same time.
Definitely. And I want to start there, too, because, Claire, your the part that you contributed to this series, really, is so compelling. And it opens with this really painful scene. It's the family of Damian Turner, who was shot nearly 6 years ago in a location that would have been, you know, this hospital, if it were open, this would have been the trauma center he would have been transported to. So his family is left with this haunting question of, you know, had he been, you know, had this center been open, could he have made it? Could we still have him if he wasn't transported to Northwestern way, way far away? As you were reporting this and talking to people, I'm sure that's just but one example. But, you know, what are those stories that stick out in your mind the most from grieving families and people that really have this kind of haunting sense by not having this medical center?
Well, you know, that is the point. Damian is actually just one person. Several names came up just as I was doing the interviews for this. One organization talked about how they joined the Trauma Care Coalition because, in fact, a young man that had participated in their programs for many years was shot and killed, and they wonder, could he have been saved? Veronica Morris Moore, who is one of the prime organizers in this movement, she talked about how the first time she sat down with Dr. Kenneth Polonsky, who is the head of the University of Chicago Medicine and reports directly to the University of Chicago's president, how the first time she sat down with him and he was talking about, you know, why they couldn't have a trauma center at USC and there needed to be a regional solution, she talked about being so angry because she had actually lost a friend. And she was sitting there thinking, you know, what if we'd had some sort of solution to this years earlier? Would my friend still be alive? So Damian is
but one
example. One person.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of really chilling sentences that you wrote in this series. You know, one though that really, really snaps it into focus so well in describing it would take 5 years, you know, but the three hospital health system eventually would reverse course and announce plans to offer the highest level trauma care at its Hyde Park campus. Then the sentence that follows that is, the racial dynamics of Chicago would shift over that stretch, with the national Black Lives Matter movement drawing attention to police shootings and activists here opposing closures of mental health clinics and neighborhood schools located predominantly in poor minority neighborhoods. And I think that's so much of what is at the crux of this conversation. And we need to take a little break, but if you would stick with us for just a bit, because I would like to talk also about the role that the plans and the discussion around the Obama Library has played in this and other recent headlines. So we'll be right back. We're talking with Kristen Schorsch and Claire Bushey, both from Crane's Chicago Business. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. I'm in for Justin Kaufman tonight. Thanks for being with us. We're with you till 11 o'clock when we turn things over to Patty Vasquez. She's got a big show for you tonight, so you definitely want to caffeinate yourself and just stay up for that. Just keep on listening. It'll be all good. All right, my friends, we've been talking about the University of Chicago, their trauma center, and there's so much to that, and it has been such a complicated issue in our headlines for so long in this city, for so many years. Recently, two journalists, Claire Bushey and Kristen Schorsch, did a small series examining this and really looking at the last several years and so much of so many of the issues around it, so much of the activism from ordinary citizens, so much of the heartbreak from families who wonder, you know, if my loved one who was injured had been had access to this facility and not transported to a trauma center far, far away, I wonder if he or she would have lived. Big questions about that. There's so much to this, so I recommend you head to chicagobusiness.com and look at this series. It is really, really compelling and so very interesting and has so much more in it in the series than we have time to get to tonight on the program. But Claire and Kristen are with me tonight on the phone to talk about this, and we were just talking a little bit about some of the activism that Claire was looking at, but I want to shift a little bit and talk now about the connection between the presidential library and museum plans for President Barack Obama and how that narrative has interwoven with this one in a way that perhaps is not so clear on the surface, but in fact is very, very connected, and a lot of people have made it even more so connected. So talk us through that a bit.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, one of the things that we found while, you know, just interviewing people and really getting a handle on what fueled U of C Medicine's reversal to finally open an adult trauma center, one of the key sticking points is, if you think about it, the activists have called for this trauma center for, you know, at least the past 5 or 6 years intensely. And, you know, one of the things that the university wants, obviously, is and has snagged is the presidential library for President Barack Obama. It would be obviously a really big tourist destination. And also, you know, the president has roots here. He taught constitutional law at the university, was a community organizer. First Lady Michelle Obama worked at the medical center. And so one of the things that we found just, you know, after digging around and interviewing people is a lot of people, you know, very prominent figures on the South Side in the activist community on their own, such as Father Michael Flager, Tim Ewell Black, who's a prominent civil rights activist who lived in Bronzeville. They very much supported the library, but they said only if you also have a trauma center. And so while U of C Medicine is saying that there were no influencing factors outside of their decision making, such as the ties to the library, to open the trauma center, there were a lot of people that we talked to that connected the dots for us. You know, I mean, it would just be such a coup for the university to get that. And then if they did get this library, well, then if you didn't also open a trauma center, you're opening yourself up to people continuing to protest for years to come. It's going to take a while to open the library.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned Michael Flager, who is you know, such an activist voice in this city, and he has really been very, very involved in this. But, you know, interestingly, as the Black Lives Matter movement has drawn attention to police shootings around the country, and as we're in an election year, in a really interesting election where there's major, you know, social issues being politicized in a way that I think most of us are not used to, at least we haven't seen in years and years, and it seems like conversations we thought were long gone have bubbled back up, especially around racial justice and racial equality. When the judge released the video showing the Chicago police officer firing bullets into Laquan McDonald, the trauma center organizers, there was a presence there too, as so many people were protesting that. And it seems, you know, so many narratives are really intertwined around this one, you know, around this trauma center, both, you know, as we're in an election year, because our president is from this city, the Black Lives Matter movement calling for police reform, there's so much to this that is so, so very, very interesting. And what was surprising to you the most? What was the most surprising as you were reporting this story and doing all this research?
You know, I guess I just think what was surprising was a lot of the, you know, behind the door conversations that people were having. You know, obviously everybody knows that, you know, the south and west sides of the city of Chicago have some of the highest rates of gunshot victims, some of the highest health disparities, unemployment, high rates of unemployment. So I think it's just, you know, tying all these things together and talking about this big, you know, broader issue with, within the lens of all these things that are disparities on the south side compared to their north side neighbors. I mean, for example, one of the biggest things for the south side are gunshot wounds and motor vehicle crashes. And so when people need a trauma center, you know, and there's nowhere to go on the south side, they end up going to Advocate Christ Medical Center in Oak Lawn, which is obviously outside of the city. So that means that Chicago paramedics have to leave the city, and then it takes them longer to get back to address another patient. You know, I think one of the really interesting things about this is, you know, you can obviously see this gaping hole on a map of where there is not a trauma center for people who live on the south side, especially in the southeast side pocket of the city. But it's not clear when you talk to people who actually research this issue, when you talk about the need of trauma centers and where they are geographically located in the city of Chicago and then on the outskirts in the suburbs, just on the periphery of the city. So there are researchers who, you know, say it's very mixed. Some studies show that there's not a significant tie between transport times and survival rates, meaning if you are shot and it takes you 15 minutes to get to a trauma center versus 25 minutes, you know, do you have a higher rate of survival? I mean, common sense would tell you, well, yes, you get there as fast as you can. If you're closer, you would think that you'd have a higher rate of survival. But there's some evidence that shows that that's just not the case, that a lot of it depends on the severity of your injury. So, like, as one researcher put it, you're in the land of gray. You know, there's conflicting research. And so I think that that's a really interesting bubble that came out of this. And I think a lot of people are going to have to really look hard and deep when UC Medicine presents their case to state regulators next month, when they ask permission to open this trauma center. You know, they're going to have to prove the need, and then how that will impact the other trauma centers in the city, because they'll obviously have fewer patients.
Definitely, and we will be looking to both of you to continue covering this really, really interesting conversation around the University of Chicago Trauma Center. So thank you so much for joining us. Everybody, head to Crane's Chicago Business, that's chicagobusiness.com, and look at this series around the University of Chicago Adult Trauma Center. It's very, very interesting, and that was put together by Kristen Schorsch and Claire Bushy. Thank you both for joining us tonight.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
All right, my friends, we are going to take a little break, and we're going to get you to news. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about two shows that have stirred up quite a bit of controversy here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight with you till 11 o'clock when we turn things over to Patty Vasquez. She's got a big show for you tonight, so you want to stick around for that for sure. My friends, right now we are joined by Sonia Soraya from Salon. She is the TV critic there. And very, very interesting stuff happening on TV right now. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Great, great. Thanks for being with us. Well, you know, I really, really enjoyed what you wrote about Confirmation, this really interesting show about the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas debacle and all of that. Really fascinating, and really couldn't agree more when you quickly get to the point that, do we know how to talk about sexual harassment? No, not really. So talk to us a little about this show.
Yeah, well, so Confirmation is it's a HBO film. It's 2 hours long. You know, it's made for TV, and it stars Kerry Washington as Anita Hill, who, you know, it is really found by Senator Ted Kennedy's investigators and Senator Joe Biden at the Times investigators when they're trying to oppose, you know, the nomination of Clarence Thomas, who is, you know, nominated by George H.W. Bush, conservative politician. So, you know, it's this whole political machine that already exists, and she's brought into it. The movie really focuses on just what happens with the hearings. It's just the confirmation. So you don't get any reenactments, which personally I think is a really good decision. You don't get any like reenactments of any alleged behavior or anything like that. You're seeing both of these people as the public saw them at the time, and what they said and their points of view, and how totally difficult it was as anyone, as a member of the viewing public, as a politician, to put these two very different stories, very different narratives of being a successful black person in America at that time, and putting them together and trying to sort out what happened there. And as I concluded, and I think as you just touched on, Amy, I feel like you end the film feeling like there was really a missed opportunity for finding a way to really talk about this or to really resolve it, because, you know, the Senate Judiciary Committee just decided to end the hearings, partly because Biden, who was the chair of it, you know, he didn't really want it to keep going anymore. The Bush administration really wanted this nominee. And so these 3 days of hearings that were very controversial and very talked about just kind of ended without, you know, anything really coming of it, except that now Clarence Thomas is on the Supreme Court. So it's a really fascinating trip back to, you know, 1991.
Definitely. And I think it's very interesting, the legacy of that, because I think even people who maybe were too young to totally know what was happening during that still anecdotally know what it means to be an Anita Hill. They know what that means to be like a whistleblower and to fight something and to stand up against sexual harassment. But not only did it not really, you know, Not only was it clear that we were ill-equipped in the early 90s to talk about sexual harassment, but to me, the way it played told me we still really are not at all.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was interesting. You know, I myself was young enough at that time that I didn't really understand what was happening, and I probably wasn't allowed to understand what was happening, to be frank. And I think when I finally did learn who Anita Hill was, she was a figure who was put together with Monica Lewinsky as these like scandalous, embarrassing, shameful people. And as it turns out, neither of them are the case. It's just that was the narrative that was the easiest for me to understand, I suppose, at that age, and maybe the one that was really prevailing for a while. I really don't. It's really hard to tell. You know, it's hard to say like where this situation would happen now. You know, both Anita Hill and Monica Lewinsky are professional women in the world still today. You're right. It's really thought provoking as to what would happen if something like this happened now, because, you know, there is so much struggle clearly depicted in the film. There's so much struggle to even define sexual harassment, to even understand, you know, I think it's Orrin Hatch, or it might be another senator on the committee at the time, asks Anita Hill, well, if this was this pattern of behavior, why haven't you said anything about it until now? And I think that's something that we understand more now, and we've really talked about it, but it's like phenomenal that it was so hard for him to understand why a victim might have trouble, you know, coming forward or something like that.
Right. Also very interesting, I think, is the timing of this film for HBO.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting, like right now, here we are just months after Justice Scalia died, and we're, you know, it's so fraught over appointing the next, you know, the next Supreme Court justice. And then we're in an election year where whoever wins the presidency will ostensibly be naming many new Supreme Court justices. And, you know, as you wrote in your piece at Salon.com, it is a political era of weaponized identity. identity politics, which I could not agree with more. That's so true. I mean, it's
Thank
a weird election, and a lot of identity politics are being brought out in a way. I was just talking about this in the last segment, in a very different and weird way than I think we have seen in decades. And it's weird and unusual. And so I think it's really interesting timing for this project for sure.
It is. It feel, even though, as I did discuss in the piece a little bit too, I wouldn't necessarily like tell someone, oh, this film is so amazing, like you have to watch it, because I don't think it's like really like, it's not necessarily like aesthetically brilliant or anything. But in terms of what it makes you think about and what it's discussing, it feels so relevant, so very timely. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah, weaponized identity politics. That was all I could think of, you know, watching this and, you know, seeing Clarence Thomas in the documentary played by Wendell Pierce, who you might know from The Wire. You know, he's talking about being a black man and how this is, he as very famously says, it's a high-tech lynching, which is a very evocative phrase, like immediately. And then meanwhile, you have the narrative of a black woman here who is, you know, trying to be professional and working in the world. It's amazing how many buttons it pushes at the same time, you know?
Yeah, definitely. It really, really does. All right, we need to take a really quick break, but there's another show I want to talk with you about, and that is the return of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt for season 2. We cannot let you off the phone without talking about that. So we'll take a quick break, and we will be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman. Right now, we're talking with Sonia Saraya. She's the TV critic at Salon. You know her. You love her. And she has been nice enough to join us tonight. So we were talking a little bit about Confirmation, the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas HBO movie that has recently aired. But I want to shift gears a little bit while we got you here, Sonia, and talk about Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Very, very funny show that is now the second season is up, and there's a lot of conversation around that, a lot. So talk to us about that a little.
Oh, well, you know, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is, so it's a Tina Fey and Robert Carlock show, Tina Fey, of course, being the more famous of the two creators. And it's, well, you're familiar with the first season, Amy, or do you want me to do a little summary of that?
Well, I am. I assume everyone is, because it was so, so funny. It was one of those shows that so many people said, you got to watch this, you got to watch this. And I finally was like, okay, I'll watch like one episode. And I sat down, I binge watched almost the whole thing. It was so funny. And so good.
It's very funny. And I want to say, I think the second season's even better. So the general plot of the show, if you don't know, it's about, it's a half hour comedy about a very unlikely topic, which is this, a woman who had been kidnapped and held in an underground bunker by a crazy religious.
Doesn't sound like a comedy, but it is.
Does not at all. But it's such a positive, inspiring. I mean, Kimmy, who's the main character, she's played by Ellie Kemper, because she's like come out into the world after being in the bunker for 15 years. She's like, everything is exciting about her for her. Like, so the title for every episode is like Kimmy doing something with an exclamation point, like Kimmy gets a job. And in the second season, you know, she's made it out. And the first season was very much about her making it out and like establishing her life. And now, you know, now that she's in the second season, she's like, oh my God, like, how do you like be a person? Like, how do you deal with the things that have happened to you that are bad or hard? But all, and like, once you get past them, how do you learn how to like, you know, to be happy, to not just survive? Which is a really, I think it's a really astute observation about recovering from any kind of trauma or any kind of hardship. And what's brilliant about the show is that it's funny. Like, and it's not just a little funny. It's like very funny. It's this very funny, full of jokes, and it's taking these really serious topics and making them into this to this roller coaster of a comedy that you just wanna be on it. Like, it's just the most fun to watch. And yeah, at the same time, as you pointed out, it has been a little bit controversial because, you know, one of the characters in the first season, it's sort of revealed. Now, this is a white actress. It's Jane Krakowski. She's from 30 Rock, if you watch that. And they're like, oh, well, she's actually Native American. She's actually Lakota Sioux. Her parents are both Lakota Sioux, and she's made herself look like a white woman because she wanted to leave her heritage. And that was – it raised a lot of red flags, rightly so, I think, because it says a lot about passing privilege that, you know, it's a longer conversation. But what I think is really great about the second season on this topic and a couple of other ones is that they haven't run away from some of the complicated racial dynamics or, you know, any sort of identity politics that they introduced in the first season, but they've really found a way to thoughtfully think about them and to that's redundant, but to thoughtfully address them and still be funny and still talk about how, you know, we have differences as people, but instead of maybe, you know, not offending each other obsessively, we can find a way to really embrace them and to be amused by them without, you know, in a way that's like loving and also funny, which I think is cool. I think it's like a good thing.
Definitely. Well, the kind of something that got kicked up about this, the second season is in the, I think, second or third episode. I think it's the third episode. Mm-hmm. This character, Titus, who's so funny mm-hmm. that has kind of helped her navigate the world. It's like all about him being an Asian woman is like, that's his true identity. And so that's gotten people kind of riled up about that. But interestingly, yeah. some really interesting, headlines have come out of that, in the, as you described it, the ecosystem of outrage, which is perfect. I love that expression. But the headlines that have come up, why Tina Fey doesn't care if you think Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt is offensive. And then Huffington Post said, after Kimmy Schmidt, Tina Fey is done explaining her jokes to you people, which is very Tina Fey. She doesn't tend to want to go back and explain things. She just kind of keeps going. She mm-hmm. she rarely will kind of go back and clarify, which is sort of her thing, like it or mm-hmm. not. And it's, I think... It makes the show, I think, in a weird way, just kind of stand on itself more and just be. It doesn't break the fourth wall, which I think a lot of other TV scandals do. There's almost an imperative to break the fourth wall and demand an explanation. Which I'm not saying an explanation is a bad thing, but it's interesting when the creators make the show speak for itself.
Well, she and the third episode that you discussed there, which Titus doesn't want to do a show about his life because he thinks it's boring and everyone has already seen the story of a gay black man who went from a football player to a performer in Times Square, which is debatable. But he believes himself to be the reincarnation of many people, including a geisha. So he really truly believes that he is this woman, which is one of the reasons it's such a fascinating story. And absolutely, Tina Fey is very much about letting the work speak for itself. You know, she doesn't want to get involved in it and meddle with that too much because I think that she feels the most confident expressing herself in the comedy that she is very good at creating. And in some ways, the episode, this third episode, is very snarky about the internet. You know, Titus makes this joke that they have to go to the public library to use internet because they don't have Wi-Fi in their house. And he's like booting up and he's like, oh, my God, people are talking about my play on the internet. That's where Beyonce and the president live, which is like amazing. But, you know, and then he encounters these people who really hate it. And then first he loves the internet and then he hates the internet. And then all these internet commenters come to picket his play and they're like totally ridiculous caricatures of themselves. And, you know, it starts out being very sharp and very snarky, but then ends up with everyone being like, oh, this is actually a good play and we enjoyed it. And it's like, oh, okay, maybe it's going to be fine.
Right. As so many of us have that love hate with the internet and internet commenters, where one good comment of, you're awesome, thanks, I love this, and then one is, you're terrible, oh, I hate the internet. It happens. It can toy with our moods. We feel you, Titus. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight and talking about these two shows. They're very, very interesting shows and interesting in that they are sitting in interesting cultural moments. So thanks so much. Sonia Saraya is the TV critic for Salon.com. Definitely hang on her every word because all that she writes is always so, so good, and we appreciate you joining us on the show tonight.
Thank you so much, Amy. Have a good one.
Thanks, you too. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and get you to news. And when we come back, we are going to be talking with Nora Gruenberg and all about the work she's doing at the new Leadership Council. And it's going to be super interesting. It's all about getting young professionals politically active. Really, really interesting stuff going on there. So we are going to be talking all about that here after the news coming up about 9:05. So stick with us. Back in a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight with you till 11 o'clock. At that time, we're going to turn things over to Patty Vasquez. She's got a big show for you, so you definitely want to stick around for that. All right, my friends, still so much on the program, so much to do. Still, we're going to be playing The Worst. You know that game. It's all good. We're going to be playing that starting at 10 with some very special guests. And a little bit later, we're going to be talking with Tribune architecture critic Blair Kamen about the ongoing drama with the Lucas Museum on the lakefront, because everybody's got a strong opinion about that one. But right now, we have some special guests in the studio. We're joined by Nora Gruenberg, who is the Chicago chapter co-director of the New Leadership Council, and John Ficuri, who is CEO of Framework Communications. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Thanks for having us,
Thanks
Amy.
For having us.
Well, so I want to start with you, Nora. Could you please just kind of break it down for us a little bit about this organization, New Leadership Council, because I'm reading political leadership and participatory democracy, and it sounds like you're doing a whole lot. So break it down for us so that we can understand all the wonderful things that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having us, Amy. The New Leaders Council is a national nonprofit organization that is dedicated to recruiting and training the next generation of progressive leaders. We have 41 chapters across the country, and we are continuing to grow and force. Our flagship program is the New Leaders Council Institute, which is a five-month program of one weekend a month trainings with a variety of different, leaders from different sectors. We pride ourselves on attracting, recruiting, and selecting progressive young leaders from all sectors, business, entrepreneurs, political, nonprofit, legal, you name it. So we are a very diverse bunch, and the idea is to help train our people to become civically engaged and to basically become leaders in their industries and to, help grow the progressive infrastructure throughout the nation.
So you're not necessarily getting people into politics per se, but just being really highly engaged citizens.
Yes, and giving them the tools that they need to achieve their goals, whether it is to become engaged in politics, to become business leaders, to become nonprofit executive directors, whatever it is that they want to do, we give them the skills and the network to do that.
Excellent. And so what age group are we talking when we say young leaders?
Typically, our members tend to be in their mid to late 20s into their early 30s. The range would probably be from 25 to 35, but we have outliers of all kinds because we are always looking for exceptional people who exemplify the progressive values that we're trying to promote.
Excellent. And what all does the training entail? If someone is in this five-month program, what skills in particular will they be picking up along the way?
Well, the first weekend is our favorite. It's the Life Entrepreneur Training, and that's where we basically help our fellows break down who they are, what it is that they want to do, and create a roadmap to get there. And some of the things that we do throughout the trainings are we provide the capability for them to develop these projects, a blueprint for their capstone projects that can be anything from programs that they'd like to create and produce to how to deliver a political campaign. So we have our alumni leaders that help the fellows to develop these roadmaps, and they've achieved various different levels of success from, again, with these political campaigns to starting up new businesses, nonprofits, and it's really exciting to see the fellows come in, sort of break down who it is that they are and that they want to be and the ideas that they want to bring to life and make that happen. It's very exciting.
Well, I know I'm quite a bit past the age cutoff. We won't get into that, but that sounds pretty interesting. I think that sounds like really useful training for anybody.
Well, you would really be a great communications trainer, so we might have to talk offline about that possibility at some
point. Sweet. I'm all over that. That sounds like a great idea. And so how many people, how many fellows are you working with at the program, in the program at any given time?
Every year we bring in about 20 to 25 fellows, depending on our applications. And we now have a network of almost 150 alumni in Chicago. And we are looking to create the progressive infrastructure throughout the nation of 10,000 by 2020.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're well on your way. And did you see an uptick in people wanting to be involved in this program as we entered an election year?
Well, I think that perhaps a little bit, but I think more than that, it's the organization is the reputation is growing every year because we attract talent from all sectors. You're going to find NLC fellows everywhere doing amazing things, being actively involved in pretty much every kind of cool event or program or initiative that's happening out there. We are everywhere, and our reputation is growing. So each year we get a higher caliber of applicants. And, you know, I have to say, if I were to have applied this year, I don't think I would have made it.
Wow.
Stiff competition.
Right. And as you look at the alumni of the program, who and what really stands out to you? Really big things that people have accomplished.
It's funny you should ask that, because our fellows this year, one of the things that we do is we have, it's a free program. The training is free, but we have the fellows organize a fundraising gala every year so that they can pay it forward for the next year's programming and to help, you know, fund fledgling chapters across the nation. So the fellows this year are, you know, pulling together their gala, and the fellows fundraiser, it's meant to bring the community together and to bring in new sponsors and to make people aware. So they're, you know, creating their marketing collateral, and so they wanted to know some of the, you know, the highlight reel from the previous classes. So I went through, our chapter was founded in 2010. So I went through each of the previous years and picked what I thought was the highlight. Lovey Ajayi is the, you might have heard of her. She's awesomely lovey. She's a blogger who's just taking the world by storm and the executive director of the Red Pump Project, which is an AIDS awareness organization. She's just taking off. She's amazing. Emile Cambry of Blue 1647 is a very, how do you say, organization Blue 1647 is a co-working space. It is a tech incubator. It is a workforce development group that helps to equip young people in the Pilsen area with tech skills. And, you know, he's putting up Blue 1647s all over the nation. He's really going places. We have Sarah Elamin, who was the executive director of Organizing for Action, who has just been named the executive director of Change.org's foundation. We have real movers and shakers in our midst, and we're only going up.
It sounds like it. Yeah. That sounds really good. Well, we have to take a little break here in a second, but we have another guest in the room that we need to get to. We need to talk to you. Who are you? No, we are also joined by John Fakuri, who is the CEO of Framework Communications. And when we come back, I want to talk a bit about how your two organizations are colliding and what you're doing together. We'll be right back here in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight, with you till 11 o'clock. Thanks for being with us. We are talking with two very special guests in the studio tonight, Nora Gruenberg, who is the Chicago Chapter Co-Director of New Leaders Council, and John Fakuri, who is CEO of Framework Communications. I'm going to turn everybody's microphone on so we can all chat and all be friends here. Well, so we have learned about New Leaders Council, but now I would love to hear about Framework Communications.
Sure. Yeah, thank you for having us, Amy. We're an organization that I'm certainly a private market and IT service firm, but really the I guess the intersection of how NORA, NLC, and Framework Communications came together is through an NLC fellow called Pete Klinik. About five, almost 6 years ago, I was stunned at the fact that the unemployment rate for veterans was higher than that of the base unemployment rate or regular unemployment rate. And one, I was stunned because, wow, there's heroes and they're left on the corner. But on the other end, I said, wow, there's $250,000 to $500,000 worth of training in individuals. Let me see if I can't make a move in helping to move our company forward. And so what we did is I went to Pete Klinik, who is the NSA fellow, but also an Army veteran as well. And I asked him how I can get started in helping to solve this problem. And I had the belief that as I looked around our organization at Framework Communications, the folks that were making the most money, the folks that were most successful weren't Harvard graduates. They weren't Stanford graduates or Cal graduates. What they were lifelong learners. They were passionate and driven to solve problems. And so I aligned what I thought to be skills I couldn't teach, things that happen when you're in the military and training that you get there, with things that we could teach. And so we worked with Rodrigo Garcia, who now is the chief investment officer for the state of Illinois, but at the time was the Veterans Department of Veterans Affairs, director of the Department of Veteran Affairs here in Illinois. And Pete connected me with him, and we were able to develop a program that's one of its kind, the first in Illinois, as I understand it. And ultimately, it's an on-the-job training program where the state of Illinois is investing in veterans. We're investing in them, and we're ultimately training them to take on a career path that will allow for them to earn 3X what they start on. And we're having the first batch of those candidates come through now and starting to become Tier 2 and Tier 3 technicians and starting to see their earnings go from X to 3X. And it's been a really rewarding facet. And so that's really how we came together and being able to tackle this problem in particular.
And where can people, if someone's listening and wants to send someone your way, where can people find out more about that?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So if you go onto our website, frameworkcommunications.com, there's a page there called Work with Framework, and it has all of our job postings there. I'd certainly encourage veterans to do that, and I'd even take it one step further. So we work with an organization that's helped to also help with the training portion, and it's an organization called National ABLE Network that's here headquartered in Chicago. And what they're able to do is they've put together Cisco and Microsoft training. So they're certified by Cisco and Microsoft to do the teach the courses and to provide the testing that's needed for them to acquire those skills, those certifications. And then after they do that, they move into my organization for 12 weeks where they do on-the-job training, as I mentioned. And so we've really been able to bridge that gap in a really cool way where you're seeing this really awesome public, private, and nonprofit partnership move in what, you know, ultimately is certainly a social problem to solve. Mm-hmm. But I encourage, as I go around the country and I talk to other business owners, you know, I came to this from a very emotional and social standpoint. You know, 9/11 happened and I was a senior in high school at the time. I went on to college and had a lot of fun and basically sacrificed zero. I saw a number of my friends come back, and that wasn't necessarily the case. And I also didn't have an avenue nor the resources to really think about the problem appropriately nor solve it. And one of the things that really came to avail is another resource from New Leaders Council, Paul Knudsen, a friend of Pete Klinik's, and I helped me think about veterans as a strategic asset, not as like these, you know, guys and girls that are putting their hands out. Because anybody who knows a veteran knows that their hands aren't out. In fact, one of the issues we have with them is getting them to ask for help. And so we thought about this differently. And so I encourage business owners to go out there and to help, you know, steal some of these candidates from me and hire these candidates, not because it's a social problem to solve necessarily. And certainly we deserve to give our heroes a chance. But also it's really lucrative. You know, people ask, you know, how did you make the Inc. 500? I submit to you that we hired American heroes and they've been able to put solutions forward that, you know, allowed Framework to grow in the way that it has. And so that's, I think, the big crux of how we've been able to work this problem.
That's excellent. That's a great success story right there with a lot of moving parts that you've pulled together really, really wonderfully. But there is an event coming up that I want to make sure that we get to before we run out of time, because indeed it goes so fast on radio. But tell us about the event coming up with New Leaders Council and how people can find out about it and support it.
Great, thanks. So Thursday, April 21st, we will be hosting an event called Champions for Change. It's New Leaders Council Chicago and Blue 1647. It will be at Blue 1647, which is at 1647 South Blue Island Avenue in Pilsen. And we are going to be featuring John Ficori along with other social change agents and entrepreneurs on our panel, including Abby Cheeseman from Skill Scout, Sonny Williams from Tiny Docs, Ethan Austin of Give Forward and Kelly O. Williams from Page and Paxton. So these are all co-founders of businesses that have a social impact and are improving the lives of people in the community and beyond. Much like John, they've seen problems, and instead of just wondering, gee, what can I do? They've done something about it. So these people are NLC alumni. These people are friends of the network. These are people that we've come into contact with just because we admire the work that we're doing and offered them an opportunity to talk about their work and to connect with the community.
I love that. That really speaks to me, because my motto is that if you catch yourself saying, someone's really got to do something about X,
absolutely,
then that someone should be you. That's,
absolutely.
That's my motto.
That's the spirit of NLC right there.
That's really excellent. So where can people go online to find out more about that event?
Go to newleaderscouncil.org, and the page will take you to the events, and you can find it on the event sidebar.
And make sure to like New Leaders Council on Facebook and follow them on Twitter. There'll be plenty of information there as well.
Most definitely.
Excellent. All good things to know. And again, you know what? I will also tweet out that link a little bit later after the show so that everybody can find it. If you follow me on Twitter or on Facebook, I'll be sure and share that link to New Leaders Council for that Thursday event. That sounds super cool. Sounds like a lot of good knowledge in one room.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us. Nora Gruenberg, who is the Chicago Chapter Co-Director of New Leaders Council, and John Ficuri, CEO of Framework Communications, doing all this great, great work with veterans. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to get you to news, and then we're going to be talking with Tribune architecture critic Blair Kamen all about the Lucas Museum, the lakefront, and all the angst swirling around it when we come back on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight with you until 11 o'clock when we turn things over to Patty Vasquez. She's got a lot of good stuff planned for you, so you definitely want to stick around for that. Stay awake, people. Stay awake. All right, my friends, you know what? I feel like we cannot go 10 minutes without hearing about all the angst connected to this Lucas Museum. Indeed, it is so fraught with so much stuff, and the lakefront and the way we feel about the lakefront and want to hang on to it or not or whatever. Everybody seems like they have such a strong feeling about this Lucas Museum. And here to help us understand it, make sense of all the angst, is our good friend Blair Kamen, who is the Chicago Tribune architecture critic. Hi, Blair. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Good. Great to hear your voice. Thanks. Thanks
good
for coming on. All right. So, you know what? It seems like every time we turn around, there's a new development with this Lucas Museum. And the latest is super interesting because it pertains to the McCormick Center space. But also, it seems like it has a silver lining, an upside and a downside to it. So break it all down for us about what is going on lately.
All right. Well, last week, Mayor Emanuel floated a new plan for the Lucas Museum. Originally, as you may remember, the building was supposed to go on what is now a parking lot south of Soldier Field. That got tied up in court by Friends of the Parks. And so with George Lucas thinking maybe about going to another city, the mayor unveiled a new plan. And this plan is to tear down the McCormick Place East Building. That's the big black convention hall east of Lakeshore Drive. In its place would be the Lucas Museum, moved about a half a mile southward on the lakefront. That would leave a lot more room for park space because the Lucas Museum would be smaller than the McCormick Place Convention Hall. Now, obviously, you need to replace that lost convention space. So the mayor is also proposing to build a bridge-like a bridge-like addition to the convention center that over King Drive, west of Lakeshore Drive, and this would unite two convention hall buildings over there, creating a huge contiguous convention hall space. All right, so those are the basics. Now today, the other shoe dropped, and we got the price tag on this, which is that this proposal would require borrowing nearly $1.2 billion, that's a B, $1.2 billion, and that's a lot of money. So it's a big plan with a very big price tag.
Certainly is. That's a huge price tag. So how did it get to the point, though? Here's the part that is very confusing, I think, to a lot of people. How did we get to the point where originally Lucas was going to come bring us this museum? It was going to be a gift. And now how is it that now we're coughing up for it?
Well, now the price tag is not simply for the museum. In other words, east of Lakeshore Drive, let me try to answer it. It's a good question. Lucas is still planning on spending a lot of money here. He, according to the deputy mayor, Steve Koch, he would put $743 million into this project. Okay, that's a serious chunk of change, especially given that Millennium Park cost $500 million. Okay, that money would go toward tearing down the existing McCormick Place building and also building the new museum. Now, the city, though, or MCPEAR, the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority, which is a city and state agency that runs McCormick Place, would still need to replace that exhibition space. So that's where you get into the extra cost, and that's roughly $500 million to construct this bridge building over King Drive, linking the two other McCormick Place buildings and upgrading space in the two remaining buildings and doing other things. So, I mean, it's kind of like mission creep. This has gone from, just one museum to, tearing down a building to make way for the museum, then replacing exhibition space for the building that would be torn down. So now all of a sudden we're doing three things, not just one. It's a much more complicated undertaking and really fraught politically. I mean, right now, we don't have a state budget. The treasurer of the state is saying she's going to, state legislators are not going to get paid right away. They're going to have to wait in line like everybody else. And so a lot of people are going to be saying, why should the state be coming forth to, help back this project at a time of fiscal crisis?
Right. It is so fraught, and there's so much around it. And I feel like for what seems like a fun thing, the Lucas Museum seems like it wouldn't be so fraught politically, but indeed, and it seems like it's really bringing out a lot of strong feelings from a lot of people, including with the prospect of 12-ish new acres of lakefront parkland, seems like mm-hmm. It's hard to say no to that. More green space in any city is always a good idea. But there's some kind of interesting pieces around that, too, even with
trees
and all that.
Yeah, that's right. In other words, McCormick Place's roof alone occupies 19 acres. So, I mean, It's great to be able to shrink that footprint and open up the lakefront. This would really be in accord with the vision of Montgomery Ward, Daniel Burnham, and others who want and the city's own planning, which really calls for an open lakefront. However, nothing's easy, and so as you mentioned, the open space around the Lucas Museum would be surrounded by like this wall of trees. In part, it would seem to shield it from the parking lot to the north on which the museum was supposed to be built. So even there, there's kind of a it's not necessarily a great – it's a minus in the sense that you want the lakefront to be continuously open, not to be kind of walled off from its surroundings like a separate precinct. Mm-hmm. So that's not good, but that can change. I mean, the planning scheme can change. I think another thing here is the big issue now is what is Friends of the Parks going to do? They brought this lawsuit in federal court. They used something called the public trust doctrine and said essentially that the Lucas Museum would be a privately run entity that controlled by, Lucas. And they have succeeded so far. The judge in the case hasn't thrown out the case as the city wanted to. And it's really tying Lucas up in knots. And so now the question is, does Friends of the Park say, we'll drop our lawsuit, we'll claim victory because we're getting rid of McCormick Place and we're creating more parkland? Or do they say, you know what, all this deal is really doing is moving this abomination, a half a mile south on the lakefront. So the ball's really in their court. They really have to make a very tough decision about, you know, whether they're going to, continue to pursue this in court or not. But, you know, they really have to see, before they were to drop their lawsuit, whether this new plan, tearing down McCormick Place, building new exhibition space west of the drive, and building a Lucas Museum where McCormick Place was, whether that has any possible chance of succeeding. And if it doesn't, they may, you know, it's conceivable that they would hold on to their lawsuit, keep fighting George Lucas, and in which case George Lucas may say, kind of take a page from Arnold Schwarzenegger and say, hasta la vista, baby.
Right.
He's already been turned down once in San Francisco. This has kind of become the museum nobody wants. It's conceivable that he could go back to the West Coast.
Very interesting. And then there's also an issue of public transportation and accessibility quickly raised with the idea of these walled trees and all that. How do people get between all these institutions,
as it goes? Right. I mean, moving the museum south is a good thing in a way because it reduces some of the clutter, which you'd have by grouping this museum with Soldier Field and McCormick Place. But on the other hand, it's like, well, you know, if me and the family are going to, the Shedd Aquarium or the Field Museum, this now becomes not an easy walk to the, to this new museum. So you got to think about, you know, how are people going to get there? Is there going to be a trolley? What kind of, mass transit access is there going to be? There's a lot of stuff to think about. But, I mean, the core issue right now really has to do with the politics and the financing and whether this plan has any chance of, making it through Springfield. And that's a long shot. I mean, I think, some people were saying this is sort of like a Hail Mary pass. And then after the Hail Mary pass, you have to have an onside kick and another Hail Mary pass.
Right.
And, it's by no means a sure thing.
Right. I fear that it might turn into like an ongoing thing like the Spire or something, another architecture story of Chicago's history that just went on and went on and went on. So we will see. But we will look to you for updates for all the latest on this and many other things architecture related here in Chicago. Thanks very much, Blair.
Thank you, Amy.
Have a great evening. All right, my friends, we are going to take a little break and we come back more of this fun. And then coming up a little bit later on the program, we're going to play the worst and we got some special guests coming in for that. So stick around. We'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight, hanging out with you till 11. Coming up in a bit, we're going to be playing the worst. So get your grievances ready to air. Tell us what is the worst. You know, just a bit ago, we were talking with Chicago Tribune architecture critic Blair Kamen about the ongoing saga of the Lucas Museum on the lakefront and how, now they're talking about moving it to an area of McCormick Place, but we got to chip in, we meaning the city of Chicago, to tear a bunch of stuff down, but yet it's going to make all this green space, and it's super, super complicated. But on the break, esteemed producer Griffin Filipich brought up a really excellent point that I think is a worthy one of discussing, because I think so many people think that it is all about Star Wars.
Right. We got a text that said all of this for a dumb Star Wars museum. And I think this conversation has been going on for so long that we kind of skip over the first part of what actually is the museum going to be.
So it's not just Star Wars.
Not just Star Wars. No, that's what I thought first, too, when I heard about it. And I'm still a little unclear on exactly what it'll be.
But it will not be just Star
Wars. It's not just Star Wars. Yeah, I think it's partly George Lucas's.
We don't know what it's going to be.
No,
it won't be just Star Wars.
Partly his fault for like putting his name on it, because his name is so synonymous with Star Wars. How could you not think it was going to be? And maybe it will be a part of the museum. I think that would be a mistake. But maybe it'll play some part. But I'm on the website. It says it's the first museum of its kind. It has an unprecedented collection that features fine art and popular art, from illustration to comics. It's all about narrative visual storytelling. So movies, comics, all that stuff. I guess the idea is that there's not really a museum that I know of dedicated, like, to the movies, you know?
Yeah, that's fair, I suppose.
So I guess that was his inspiration. I don't, you know, take from that what you will. I don't know if that sounds great to you, but yeah, it's not just a Star Wars museum.
He perhaps needs a little bit of help with the branding, because I think people do think it's a Star Wars museum. In fact, even as we talk about it, like, and all the headlines that describe this whole situation, it's always about the mayor strikes back, the city strikes back, public spaces strike back, or, you know, there's always like a Star Wars play on words involved in the way we talk about the Lucas Museum. And I think you're right. I don't think any of us bothered to ask that question. What's in it?
Well, let's be honest here. There have been, what, about 25 Star Wars movies now? There are enough Star Wars people out there that would certainly be able to support this museum from now for the next 100 years. For me, it's politicians' inability to admit defeat. I don't know if there are a lot of people out there that really want this thing built on either of these proposed sites.
Well,
that's the vibe that I'm getting,
right,
anyway.
Part of it is there's a lot of criticism about what it looks like.
Not pretty.
People are calling it the Jabba the Hutt's palace. I mean, it looks like a volcano. It looks like the volcano science project that we did in elementary school.
Yeah.
With the baking soda and the food dye and the vinegar. I mean, that's kind of what it looks like to me.
And I never got mine to work either.
Poor Martyr. He's still hanging on to that.
Rob, were you behind the design of this museum?
Not at all.
No? Okay.
No.
Well, it is interesting, and I thought it was really useful the way Blair came in, who was just on with us, the way he broke that down, because I think there is a little bit of confusion as to, wait a minute, I thought Lucas was paying for this. How come we're chipping in this huge amount? We're not paying for it. He's still paying a lot of money. I don't remember the number.
760-some-odd million?
Not insignificant. That is way more than I have in the cup holder. Sitting like in the, you know, the change dish that I collect loose coins in, way more than that. It's still a lot of money, but what needs to happen is like the demolition to make room for it, especially if it moves a little bit south toward into the McCormick Place campus. That's where the price tag starts going up for the city, because it's not George Lucas's problem to demolish and reroute things that already exist. His money kicks in at the building.
$1.2 billion is the projected cost to us here.
Where I'm from, we call that a crap ton of money.
Right. Yeah. And $664 million of that would be, as you just suggested, Amy, to tear down the Lakefront Convention Center, actually build the museum, pay for other construction initiatives that surround the project, parking, what have you, to support the building of this museum. I mean, the costs are astronomical.
That's so much money. Meanwhile, I mean, it's so hard to, you know, also as Blair was saying, it's so hard to think about spending money on this when, you know, we have this, you know, budget crisis, and we have, you know, unemployment, and we have people who literally did not get to eat today because they could not afford to do so. And I have such a hard time justifying this kind of thing as like a long-term infrastructure asset when, you know, there are children who did not eat dinner tonight. You know what I mean? I have trouble with that.
Yeah, and just to come back around on what exactly it will be, I got it in one sentence here,
okay,
finally. The Lucas Museum will celebrate the power of visual storytelling in a setting focused on narrative painting, illustration, photography, film, animation, and digital art. And if that's not worth $1.2 billion to you, I don't know what is, right?
I think he needs a better PR team, because I think I need a little more clarity of what that is, because then that's going to be one of those things that only like diehard fans will go to, and they'll say things later like, oh, you know what? Turns out it's not just Star Wars. There's a lot of cool stuff in there. I didn't realize. That's kind of, it'll be word of mouth then. So who knows if this is going to even be built? My prediction is I think this is going to become like the Spire, because it's so hard to get things done in the city with so much red tape. I think we're going to drive George Lucas crazy, and he's going to be like, you know what? Screw it. I'm out. I'm going somewhere else. And it's going to end up being somewhere super weird that we've never heard of, but it'll be like a great tourism opportunity for a smaller town. That's my prediction.
Look at the headaches that the Ricketts were given because they wanted to improve. Let's be honest. a cruddy ballpark. I mean, Wrigley Field, prior to the improvements, was a dump. And the city put that made them jump through flaming hoops before they could spend their own money to improve the park. I mean, I love Chicago. I love what the city has to offer. I really do. I would recommend it to anybody. But sometimes we can't save us from ourselves. I mean, it's just incredible. Right. It really is maddening.
Right. I'm with you. I also love Chicago dearly. I love it so much I've moved here twice. But, yeah, it gets very frustrating when we just kind of get caught up in the way things have always been done. Like the process bogs us down, I think, and holds us back. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. We're going to get you to news. And we come back, the time-honored tradition of playing Monday night's The Worst will continue and march on, and we've got some special guests coming in to play The Worst. So get your grievances ready to air as we will be playing The Worst to decide what is the worst. We want to hear from you, of course. 312-981-7200. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
Worst.
WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman. As is the custom on Monday evenings at this time, it's time to play The Worst. It is the fine game where we air our grievances. It's like Festivus, right? Where you air the airing of the grievances happens, and it is all called The Worst. We're going to be giving away some fun stuff this evening. So get your grievances ready. 312-981-7200. We've got a big crowd playing with us tonight because Rob Martier up in news, he's playing. Esmeralda Leon up in traffic, she's got some grievances. And we've got two special guests in the studio, our very own Sam Panionovic. You know him. He's all about the sports. You turn to him for so much sports knowledge, it's not even funny. He's here. He has a grievance. And our good friend Landis Wiedner. She is a filmmaker here in Chicago, an entrepreneur, woman about town, doing lots of cool stuff. And she is here, and she has got grievances, too. There are people that were walking by as I was saying that, nodding as I was talking about grievances. So I think lots of people got lots of grievances tonight. So as is the custom, Griffin, the producer, esteemed producer Griffin Filipich, will be starting, but he's on the phone because there's callers already ready to air their grievances. So I'm going to switch it up a little bit. Let us begin. Let us kick it off. I feel like Rob Martier has a grievance burning a hole in his pocket by the look on his face right now.
When you get the prompt to change your password for anything, you know, your sign in, your logon at work, what have you, and you go to change the password, and then it prompts you that you either don't have enough characters, you haven't put in a capital letter, you haven't put in the proper symbol, and you go through this about a half dozen times, and it makes you feel really inadequate and dumb, that's the worst.
That's the worst, yeah.
That happened to me earlier today.
I'm going to take that.
I felt really embarrassed.
Embarrassed. I, you know what? I hate it when you like have already checked the box, remember this password, and then you've like screwed it up, and they don't offer you that again, and then it messes you up the next time you go to log in. Oh, that's the worst.
That password doesn't match the one you just put in. I'm sorry.
Or you already used that one, jerk.
That's right.
Oh, Esmeralda, what do you got? What's the worst?
Right now, the worst is when you're peeling a hard-boiled egg, and half of the white just goes with the shell.
Oh, yeah.
You ever done that?
Yeah.
And you're just like, great, I'm just going to eat, I guess, a yolk.
Or you try to like scrape it out of the shell.
I don't even see. I've never even gone that far.
I have one that is food related also, and that is the weird phenomenon of avocado speed rot. Like that avocado is perfect for 3 days, and then like suddenly you're like, one morning you get up and you look at it and you're like, I'm going to eat that avocado for lunch. And then you come back and it's been like an hour and the whole thing is like unusably brown, rotten, gross avocado.
Totally.
Avocado speed rot, Amy Guth's first world problem right there. All right, I'm going to turn this to my esteemed guest now, Landis Wiedner. What is the worst?
So I think it's the worst when you're trying to sneak a photo of someone on the CTA and your phone is on silent, yet somehow that little snappy noise goes off still and you get busted for taking a photo of, like, hypothetically a very cute older gentleman eating an ice cream cone because you want to send it to your friends who also have an affinity for older gentlemen eating ice cream cones.
I see.
And then everyone stares at you for taking a photo on the CTA.
But does it work? Does it get his attention? And he's like, hey, that lady's taking my picture. Someone's
I should
here.
Say older as in elderly.
Oh.
So very cute older
I
elderly.
See.
The question stands, I think.
Right. Right. You're not answering the question.
Yeah, he wasn't impressed.
my friends, 312-981-7200. Tell us what is the worst. We're going to be giving away all kind of good stuff tonight. Hi, Ron. You're on WGN. What is the worst?
I'm telling you, I'm sick of this political infighting, name-calling. Now Trump's calling everybody names. And can't these – they're all adults. They're not kids in a schoolyard anymore. Can't they just run, you know, a campaign addressing the issues of America instead of acting like children? I mean, it's like the best of the worst. Who are you going to vote for? The best of the worst.
Yeah.
To run our country.
That's a good
one.
You know,
it's terrible. You know, Trump's calling Hillary names. He's calling Cruz names. He's calling Rubio names. You know, I mean, it's how old are these people? They're not 4 or 5 in a schoolyard anymore.
Right. Thanks. You know? Thanks very much for the call, Ron. I agree. I feel like it's like I would be more apt to just everybody get in a big old slap fight and let's get it done so we can then talk about some real actual issues. All right, my good friend Sam Paniatovich, what is the worst?
I don't get angry often.
Oh, boy.
I try and channel this.
I feel like we need theme music right now.
I have never been angrier. This was this past, I don't know, January or February, blizzard weather, right? Like maybe like 10, 20 degrees. And these new parking lots, they don't have attendants anymore. They have what? The machines.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
And you either, you know, and everybody who's normal pays with a credit card. You put the card in and you leave.
You're
well,
a quarter guy.
This elderly person, I won't specify gender, decided to pay the $20 fee in a blizzard. Probably, you know, you need gloves. Your hands are freezing. The line goes through three people. The fourth person pays a $20 parking fee in singles.
Oh, no. No.
So imagine how long that takes, especially when the fifth dollar wouldn't go in. So you're standing in the middle.
Did you manage to get
a
picture
frozen tundra
of the elderly person?
I did not. Okay. I did not. It took, I promise you, it took her about 20 minutes to pay this parking fee. And you feel bad because you're trying to be nice and be respectful respect your elders, but
you're also like, give me that. Here's a 20. Just go.
Just
put on my
credit
card.
I will pay for it. Right. I will swipe twice if I have to. So get a credit card. It's 2016.
A couple automobile-related worsts coming in on the text line, similar to yours. The first one we got was before 10, seasonal allergies.
Sure, that's the worst.
The worst. Mm-hmm. We also just got the worst is when you're following someone with their blinker on for mile after mile.
Oh, yeah.
And finally catch up to them to tell them, but they don't understand what you're trying to tell them and flip you off and continue to drive with their blinker on.
That's a good one. You know what? I like that one because there's no universal symbol for, hey, your blinker's on. What do you do?
Right.
Like,
wave.
If you make the symbol for, like, putting the blinker on, it looks like you're doing the trucker honk your horn thing.
Sometimes I'll flash my lights when I notice something odd like that going on, but I think that's probably not a good idea. And also, there's no way to understand what I'm trying to communicate there. But I just feel like I have to do something, and I'll just throw that out there. Like, hey, it's just a hey. Maybe they'll figure it out.
Yeah, because there's like universal symbol for bring us the check. Make the check mark on your hand with your eyebrows up. That's that.
But do you say check or do you not say check?
That's the age-old debate. You mouth check.
Right, you don't say check out loud. Some people say it out loud,
rude.
And it's rude.
I don't like to do that. I'll, like, wave and then go, hi, can we get the check? I like to say it, like,
quietly. It's like a different voice.
Yeah.
Right?
But
yeah.
You get the one guy that goes, check!
Yeah.
And the whole restaurant looks and, like,
like
oh,
that
wow.
Guy. Yeah.
Take it easy.
You can avoid that whole debacle by just not paying,
I find.
If you just leave before that even becomes part of it.
Eat, get up, out you go, right?
It's a thought.
All right, my friends, we're playing the worst. We want to hear from you, 312-981-7200. Sam Paniatovich is here and Landis Wiedner. We will be right back. We want to hear from you about what is the worst. We are airing the grievances, as we do on the station on Monday evenings. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman this fine evening with you till 11 o'clock when we turn things over to Patty Vasquez. She's got a really big show for you tonight, so you definitely want to stick around for that. My friends, as is the tradition on Monday evenings on this esteemed station, we play a game called The Worst, and it is much like Festivus with the airing of the grievances, but basically you tell us what is the worst, and what we decide is the worst. If we agree with you, you make us laugh, we're giving away some Luminati's gift cards. You can have a pizza on us, so that is all good. It's win-win. You call and complain, we give you pizza. Easy enough, right? So 312-981-7200 is the number to get you to esteemed producer Griffin Filipich, and he will chat with you about what you think is the worst. But I also have some esteemed guests in the studio too. Landis Wiedner, she's a filmmaker and entrepreneur here in Chicago, and she's working on a project called Type One. It is both super funny and super educational all at the same time. It's all about raising awareness of type 1 diabetes. You can find out all about that. We're going to give out some social media channels and all that good stuff here in just a bit. And Sam Panionovich is here. You know him from WGN Sports. He is all about the sports. We go to him for so much information about what is happening in the sports world. So these guys are hanging out with me, and we are airing the grievances. Landis, where can people go to find out more about your project?
You can check out Level Productions, LVLProductions.com, or check out our Twitter at Type One Show. And we'll have more updates coming as we're just cranking out more on making diabetes funny.
Sure, yeah, as one does. Yeah. And it's a web-based series.
Yeah.
And so you're in production right now as we speak?
Yeah, we're in pre-production right now. So yeah, we're tightening up the writing, and then we're going to be shooting this summer.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, we're going to all follow you and look for updates on that. Okay, let us get back to the grievances. I have another one, and that is, I kind of hinted at this last week already, but it has come up again. So last week I was a guest on the show with Justin Kaufman, and one of my grievances was the way chocolate is advertised to women, like, it's the only thing we're allowed to be sexual about. Like, right. Like you can be sensual about chocolate, right, but nothing else. Like, God forbid you talk about a man that way and you're, yeah, some kind of like horrible slut, right? So I was griping about that. But I don't like chocolate. It gives me a headache. It's no good, whatever. When you tell people that, they think there is something really the matter with you. Mm. And the strangest things come out of people's mouths when you tell them you don't like chocolate. So that is the worst. They judge you horribly if you do not like to eat chocolate.
Now, am I judging you right now? I'm not going to say, you know,
judging me for the last 3 hours.
It's just, it puts you in a position where you can't understand the other person's side. Taste is one of those things.
I guess.
It's the worst when you don't know what to say.
People are flipping weird.
To someone that doesn't like chocolate.
You can just be like, really? I'm allergic to corn. Cool. We both have food allergies. That's all you have to say.
You are so right, though. They market chocolate, and the other thing is like a dead animal, right? Like if there's like a girl wearing like a dead animal in a magazine, like that's supposed to be sexy, too.
Yeah, she's like petting it.
Yeah, it's like a leopard, you know, it's a leopard rug, and she's wearing it, and it's like, she's right, chocolate or a dead animal. That's how you're marketing.
Very, very sexy. Yes.
Yeah, for sure. Let's get to some of these calls. Hi, Sue. You're on WGN. What is the worst?
The worst is when you spend a lot of time and money painting your house just so you can sell it, and the new owners paint over all of it.
Oh, that
because
is the
it
worst.
Takes over a week to paint the whole house, right? It's a lot of labor, Sue.
Yeah. It's a lot of work. Oh. And a lot of money, too. It's a lot of money.
Especially, but maybe that's why they bought it.
Wash it all down.
When they paint it an ugly color, right? It's an ugly color. That's even worse.
Right. Exactly. That would be the worst.
But, Sue, maybe you provided the vision with your color. You were just the springboard.
Maybe. Here's hoping. Gosh, you're right, Sue. That is the worst. Thanks so much for calling. I'm going to put you on hold for a second.
Thanks.
Sue. All right. Mike, you're on WGN. What is the worst?
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
I've actually got two for you now because I came up with another one on the way here.
All right.
Oh, you're going to love this one. Okay, the first one, the one I actually called about was, you know, I went to a restaurant the other day and I went to pull up there, went to adjust the table to let my friend in on the other side. So as I'm pulling the table out, I got a handful of fresh bubble gum.
Ew.
All over me. Absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, that's pretty gross. That's the worst.
I didn't know people did that
outside of seventh grade.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, disgusting.
Gross.
The second one was, see, I'm a chocolatier I own a chocolate shop, and I make my own chocolates for a living. And when you call a radio station, the host says how much they hate chocolate.
Oh, they can't eat chocolate. No, you know
You're
what
like,
it is?
Oh, come on.
I'll tell you what it is, Mike. I think it's fine. It has something in it called tyramine that is a migraine trigger. And so I get a terrible
migraine.
Oh, yeah,
I totally understand.
So it is not... Yeah. It is not. I have chefs in my family. I have nothing but admiration for chocolatiers and the beautiful work that they do. And
I was like, oh, what's the odds? What are the odds?
Love chocolate.
Right. Landis, on the other hand,
if you
want to
send some, you know,
I could
to
do
the
that.
Studio in care of Landis Wiedner, I will enjoy it, Mike.
So, Mike, if there's, say, for example, there's a single guy listening right now and he wants to know what's the best kind of chocolate to buy for a girl he's trying to woo, what would you say?
First, find out if she likes chocolate.
Yeah, that's number one.
No. you think they like chocolate because most people do. But that being said, Mike, what type of chocolates should the aforementioned single guy get?
Always truffles, and always go with dark chocolate.
All right.
You know, and raspberry truffles are always top of the list.
Ooh, okay. That's fancy. All right. We have an expert.
Sexy already.
Mike, I'm going to call you the chocolatier correspondent for WGN Radio. There. I dub thee.
We could do that.
Sweet. It's a thing. Anytime I have a chocolate-related question and I need an expert to weigh in on it, you're the guy. Sweet.
Thank you.
All right. Good times. All right. Thanks very much for listening, Mike, and thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right. Let's keep rolling. Hi, Patty. You're on WGN. Patty, are you with us?
Oh, Patty, yes, that's me. Hi. This really gets me mad, especially when you're in a hurry, which I usually am. You're approaching a red light intersection, and you're the second car, and the light turns green, and the car in front of you will not move into the intersection, so you've missed the whole cycle and have to wait a whole nother cycle.
Oh, that's a good
one. Because only one car can get through the intersection.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good one. Yes.
Oh, totally agree.
That is the worst.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for calling, Patty.
Okay. Bye.
Oh, man, that's a good one for sure.
It
all right, my
a lot
friends.
In Chicago, too.
It really does. Yeah. We have short lights here or something. All right, my friends, we got to take a little break and get you to news. We're hanging out with Landis Wiedner, filmmaker and entrepreneur right here in Chicago, and our very own Sam Panionovich. We will be back in just a bit. We want to keep hearing from you. What is the worst? Because we're giving away some Lou Malnati's pizza to the folks who really have the worst grievances to air. So keep those calls coming, 312-981-7200. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman tonight with you until 11 o'clock when we turn things over to our good friend Patty Vasquez. She has a big show for you tonight, so you definitely want to stick around for that. As is the custom, my friends, it is Monday evening, and therefore we are following the tradition of playing It's the Worst right here on WGN, because that's what we do. We play the worst, and we talk about we air grievances that are the worst. And in studio with me tonight, Landis Wiedner. She is a filmmaker and entrepreneur. You want to learn about all the stuff she's doing, including a project called Type One that is a comedy series bringing together both a super, super funny comedy series and the very serious educational quest that she is on to educate people about Type 1 diabetes. So you definitely want to check that out and all the cool stuff she's doing with that, and look for it when it comes out. It is on its way. And our good friend Sam Panionovich is here. You know him from WGN Sports. So we are here. We are airing our grievances, and we are taking your calls, 312-981-7200. Please tell us what is the worst. The ones that we collectively as a panel here tonight in the studio decide are indeed the worst. We're going to be giving you some Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's, of course, is the home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnatis.com. All right, my friends, let us go back to the phones. Hi, John. You're on WGN. What is the worst? Hi, John.
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How are you? What's the worst?
Good, good. The worst is when you go to a grocery store, you're in a hurry, you go to the self-serve lane, and the person in front of you has no clue how to scan the merchandise or pay for their products.
Yes, or they're buying alcohol and they got to wait for 10 minutes for someone to come, you know,
right,
check their ID. Oh, you're right. That's a good one. That is the worst. Thanks very much, John. Thanks for the call.
Thanks, Amy.
All right, Sarah, you're on WGN. What is the worst?
The worst is getting stung by a bee when you're driving.
Whoa. When did that happen?
Today. I was at a stoplight and all of a sudden I felt something. I didn't see any bees, but the window's open. It's beautiful today. And it hurt so bad. And then the light turned green. I turned into the first place I could go, and I was coming from the gym, and it was beautiful out, so I was just wearing a sports bra and, you know, with my workout pants.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I pulled over. Yeah, I was like, I felt great. And then I pulled over to the first place I could go to because it hurt so bad, and I felt the little wings in between my skin and my bra. So I just, like, in a panic, ripped my bra off and realized that I am in front of a Mexican restaurant with, and I'm topless at 11:30. I don't even
Sarah.
Know.
Sarah, oh my God. You made Landa snort.
I swear.
Sarah, oh, honey, my God. You didn't mention where the bee stung you. Oh, no.
I apologize.
That is the worst.
No, don't apologize.
I was going to say, I don't.
It's okay. We're all visualizing now.
You have. Never mind
you
what
think
sent.
That's what they really look scared. They did not look like it was kind of a crazy, like,
oh my God.
It kind of looked like a basketball kind of moment. You know,
it could have been worse. It could have happened when you were driving, like mid expressway, right?
That's true.
And then you swerve because you just got stung and you don't know what happened.
He just pointed at his boob when he did that.
I felt kind of betrayed by the trucker. I hope he's listening because the light was red when I first got stung and he saw this all happening and then it turned green and I was like freaking out and he just went. It was like, thanks. Okay. I'll get this on my own.
Wow.
So
he didn't even stay for the best part.
Wow. Sarah, that is the worst. That is not even a thing I had ever considered, and now that's a thing to worry about.
I was completely naked from the waist up in front of a Mexican diner. It was just windows everywhere.
Sarah, bless your heart.
Uh-huh.
Well,
I'm going to have a drink tonight.
I was going to say.
I hope you got a margarita.
Bottle.
Oh, my gosh.
Tequila after that.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah. All right. Thanks so much for the call, Sarah.
Well,
oh, my gosh.
You.
That is the worst. That is the worst.
Oh, my
that
God.
Is I can't even imagine getting stung by a bee on your boob in your sports bra. That sounds really terrible.
I would be
terrible.
Too drunk to call right now.
I would be very upset about that. Hi, Ronnie. You're on WGN. What is the worst? Hi, Ronnie. What's the worst?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear my name. You know, I am not one of the workers, but I was reading where the CEO of CVS makes $13,000 an hour, Starbucks $9,000 an hour, and they won't give the workers a raise, a little raise, up to $15. So I was very sad.
Oh, that is a good one. Yeah, mm-hmm. The disparity between the workers and the leaders, right, sometimes is a very, very wide, wide berth. That is a great point. Thanks so much for the call, Ronnie. Have a great night.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
All right. Mary, you're on WGN. What is the worst?
Hello.
Hi, Mary. What's the worst?
The worst is usually when somebody invents something new, you would think, oh, that's a good thing. Like, but no Nobel Prize for this guy who invented the toilet that flushes itself. I am not a big woman. I'm an average-sized woman. Every time you go to a public toilet, okay, so it's self-flushing. You sit down. You barely bend over to get a piece of toilet paper, and you get this dirty douche because it decides for you that you're done, and it flushes. And I try to be so careful, but I'm like, oh, whoever invented that, no.
There are people walking by outside just laughing right now at what you just said, for the record.
I mean,
Mary.
Unless you're really a wide load, no offense over there. Maybe you don't know what I'm talking about, but...
Well, we got you, Mary. We got you.
Mary, I could not agree more, right? Like, you sit down to pee, and the toilet flushes. You move to get toilet paper, it flushes again. You stand up, and then, like, after you're done and you've actually flushed, and then you're putting your jacket back on, or it's usually in an airport, you're picking up your suitcase or something, it'll flush again. So it'll flush, like, five times while you're just in there, just a tinkle.
Yeah. Somebody just got to undo that.
Yeah, you're right. That's not an environmentally sane, sound practice, for sure.
Not just that, but when it gets up, it backfires on you.
I hear... Backfires. Splashback is horrifying, and that is why porta-johns are terrifying to me, because I live in fear of splashback.
Right?
I hear you, Mary. Preach on. Good one.
Okay.
Thanks so much for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
See, that's a good one. She is totally right. The splashback.
Yeah.
In terms of automated bathroom situations, I don't want to – I'll just say bathrooms with automatic lights that will turn off and on with movement.
Uh-huh.
If that bathroom doesn't have a lot of traffic and say you're the only one in there.
And you're in there for like 45 minutes.
Who knows? No. Let's say maybe 5 minutes.
You're not speaking from experience, are you?
I don't know what you're talking about. Of course not. Of course not.
You're that guy that goes to the bathroom at the bar or the restaurant?
No.
You know what? The WGN bathrooms on the 7th floor, they have like an automatic.
Really?
Yeah, they have a timer, including that super haunted women's bathroom up there. Super haunted. You don't want to be in the dark in there. It's spooky.
I don't like those either. Excuse me.
No. He's like such a hurry to turn his microphone off. He's cutting himself off. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. We're hanging out with Landis Wiedner. She is a filmmaker here in Chicago and our very own Sam Panionovich. And we are talking about what is the worst. There's so many grievances to air this fine evening, and we are airing them all. And we're giving away Lou Malnati's gift certificates for the worst of the worst. So we'll be doing that when we come back here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth in for Justin Kaufman. As per the tradition here on this station on Monday evenings, we are playing the worst. It is the night where we air our grievances and decide what is the worst. I mean, we're not talking like genocide. Clearly, that's the worst. We're not talking about that. We're talking about like first world level, the worst. And we have gotten so many fascinating calls, some cringeworthy, some hilarious, some all of those things. Thank you so much for the calls. Call us. Let us know what is the worst. 312-981-7200. I'm here with my special guest tonight, our very own Sam Panionovich from WGN Sports, and Landis Wiedner. She's a filmmaker and entrepreneur right here in Chicago, and you want to find all the cool stuff she's working on, including a series right now called Type One that is really, really cool, and you are going to super love it. And there may or may not be an extra in one scene who is super hot and looks just like me. I'm just saying.
Amazing.
Just saying. Throwing that out there.
A couple good texts. I haven't been able to get to the texts.
Yeah. What you got?
Because we were so busy with the calls. But, okay, the worst is when you run into an old flame behind you in line at the store, but you forgot to figure in the tax. You are short a dime by what you need. Sad face.
Oh, that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be like, and you, because it's, you always run into an ex when you're like, I'll just run out real quick.
No makeup
and sweatpants. Yep. It'll be fine. And you're like, oh, damn it. And you've got a new girlfriend, and she's real hot.
Uh-huh.
Damn it. It's always that.
I've never ran into an ex anywhere, ever.
Really?
Or maybe you just didn't know it, and she hid in the cereal aisle or
right.
something.
She was like, crap, Sam, crap.
That's a great place to hide. There's nothing harder than picking out a cereal in the cereal aisle.
Sure.
Oh, you walk through the cereal aisle, you are so confused as to what to do.
It's true.
All right. Other grievances that we have, and then we got to give away some Lumanized pizza because there are some worst things happening. You know what? I'm going to throw out there this new app that's like Uber for women called Chariot for Women.
It's based in Boston, yes?
I think so. I didn't even look that far. I want no part of this because sectioning people off is not the answer. Let's deal with Uber drivers who are committing crimes against women
right.
instead of saying, well, here's what's normal, and if you don't feel safe, go do this other thing. I'm good with options, and I'm good with, like, this guy, or actually it's a married couple, them, you know, saying, hey, here's a problem, let's do something about it. Kudos to them for that. But it's very Victorian in the, like, separate spheres way. I wrote an op-ed about it this week because I'm super angry about it, and I think it's nonsense. Nonsense, I tell you. All right, Ed, you're on WGN. What is the worst?
This is Ed and Joliet.
Hi, Ed.
Yeah, I love your show, and I have a worst that happens far too often.
Tell me.
You're in the big box store, and you get behind the shortest line with maybe only one or two people, and there's a 15-minute price check required, but they have to go to the back of the store.
Yeah.
It happens far too often. The shortest line never is.
Right, and then you see the people in the super long line, they're blowing out of there. They're done.
They're already gone.
They're long gone. That's totally true, Ed. That's a good one. Thanks so much for the call.
All right.
Have a great evening.
Thank you so much. Love your show.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
He was so nice. We love Ed. All right, so my esteemed panel here, Landis Wiedner and Sam Panionovich, we need to give away some pizzas. So let us decide here, what is the worst? Every call was so good. every call and every text. They were all so funny and so good. I feel like we definitely need to give a Lou Malnati's pizza to our friend Sarah.
Yes.
Because this poor woman, you guys, the worst to her happened today, and that was she went to the gym and she's all working out, and then a bee flew into her car, down her top, and stung her on the boob while she was driving. That is the worst. That is a thing I never even thought about worrying about, and now I got to worry about that.
You buried the lead.
I did. She
of the
did.
Story. No, like you forgot the second part of what happened to Sarah.
Oh, right. And then as if that wasn't bad enough, then she like pulls over to deal with the bee sting and the bee in her top, and she whips off her sports bra in front of a Mexican restaurant, and lots of people saw her. So that's not. That's a rough day, and I feel like the least we can do is give her a Lou Malnati's pizza.
The very least.
I think that's fair.
I feel like we should like send her flowers and maybe a bottle of wine because that's a really rough day. But nonetheless. Lou Malnati's pizza to you, Sarah, for sure. I also, you guys, tell me what you think, my esteemed panel here. I got to go also with our friend Mike the Chocolatier, who I insulted while he was on hold by saying I don't like chocolate, and he's devoted his life to chocolate.
That was pretty amazing.
So we're going to send a Lou Malnati's pizza gift card to you, Mike, who I am dubbing the official Chocolatier correspondent of WGN Radio. Don't think I'm not going to take you up on that.
Willy Wonka's going to be upset.
I know. So mad. He's like, damn it, that
kid's on line 7 waiting to
he's
talk to you.
So mad. So mad. Also, Sue. She painted the house to sell the house. New owners painted it something else. That's rough.
Yeah.
That's super rough. I know someone who had this light blue living room, painted it white to sell the house, and then they like the new owners, like she was kind of like stalking on social media to see what they were decorating, what they were doing. They painted it almost the same color blue. She was like, really?
Oh, yeah.
I did all that?
What is the point?
Damn it.
Yeah.
Right. So, Sue, to you for the trouble of painting the house. Good times.
Mm-hmm.
Good times. Other worthy mentions, or I think those are the highlights to me.
No, those were worthy. Can I make a late admission?
Yeah.
I just thought of something.
Tell me.
Bad service at a restaurant or bar.
Well, yeah.
Is up there for me. Like when you order your eggs sunny side up and they come back scrambled and you.
Not even close.
Him or her know and they go, fine. And then they take them back and then it takes
definitely
a bit
spit in your food at that point.
You know,
yeah.
You know, vodka soda and you get a vodka Coca-Cola. And, you know, it's just like. And then they're mad at you when you say that that's not what you ordered.
Now, I will flip that narrative a little bit. Let's flip the script. When I used to wait tables, people would, you know, you bring them their food and they'd be like, this. And I'd say, hey, will you cut that steak and see if it's cooked to your liking? And they'd be like, no, there's your tip. It's gone. Your tip's gone. Like, I didn't cook it, nor did I cut it for you. I'm asking you to cut it to check it. I'm looking out for you.
Extra
jerk.
Service.
Yeah. If anything, my tip should go up. Jerk. Anyway.
And now you know, Sam, why waiters are so angry.
See? So many grievances.
We have a lot of grievances.
So many grievances.
A lot of great texts still. Let me just get one more in there before we go. The worst, when you're talking face-to-face with someone and the person spits on your face, you don't want to embarrass them and wipe it off while they're standing there.
Oh, that's a good one.
So you're forced to stand there with spit, and I love this word choice, marinating on your skin.
Oh,
that's really true.
Wow, the imagery there is just fantastic.
If I do that, if I accidentally spit on somebody, I'll tell them. I'll be like, oh, my God, I just spit on you. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Because that's happened to me one time, someone like, and it landed like on my glasses, and I could see it.
Is this wind-assisted? Is that what we're talking about?
No, it was a close talker, which is the worst.
Oh,
close talkers are the worst.
Okay.
I put close talkers and loud people that like chew and breathe loud at the same time, loudly.
Mm.
That makes me so angry.
Yeah.
So angry. Anyway, my friends, we got to take a break. We got to turn things over to our good friend Patty Vasquez. She's got a big show lined up for you. Special thanks to my guests, Landis Wiedner, filmmaker here in Chicago. Check out her project Type One. It is going to be super awesome. It is in pre-production right now, but look for it coming to you soon. It's a comedy series. It's going to be really, really great, educating people about Type One diabetes. And special thanks to our very own Sam Panionovich from WGN Sports, hanging out with me late tonight to play The Worst. We'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN.